The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Greetings, everyone. I'm Jennifer Green for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is That's a Laugh. For the next half hour, I'll be reading excerpts of funny stories, quotes, and other anecdotes from various sources that we hope will add a few chuckles to your day. This time of year is filled with stories of mysterious creatures. Today, we'll hear about the most mysterious creature of them all, the butty. What is a butty, you ask? We find out from Bill Lepp's book, Armadillo Recon Unit and Other Tall Tales, first published in 2004, the chapter, The Butty Mystery. New rumors about Bigfoot had started up again late last fall. There had always been stories passed around in Half Dollar about a Bigfoot, but nothing very reliable. But last fall, no less a respectable citizen and outdoorsman than Old Man Sullivan had reported to the crowd at Billy the Kid's tombstone, the local tavern, that he himself had seen massive tracks in the mud by a stream he was fishing. He said it couldn't have been a bear or a man, and he doubted it was an ape or anything like that. Old Man Sullivan had said the word Bigfoot. The rumor mill soon became littered with reports of sightings and tracks in the woods. Skeet and I were skeptical, but vigilant nonetheless. As a rule, we didn't believe in Bigfoot, but a fellow couldn't be too careful. Nobody wanted to engage in hand-to-hand combat with a mythical creature of great strength and intelligence. Skeet and I already had the odds stacked against us when it came to the double whammy of strength and intelligence. Rumors wilted a bit during the holiday season, but started up anew in mid-January. This time, Sheriff Hasbro told us about a sighting. While we sat quietly, albeit unwillingly, in the back of his patrol car, after running a snowmobile accidentally through the ice atop the deep end of the city pool, Hasbro told us that a large hairy beast was recently spotted rummaging in the city dump. "Sheriff," I scolded from the back seat, "you should be more careful when you go to the dump." "And you," he glowered, "should be more careful when you ride your snowmobile accidentally up the high dive ladder." "Did the beast leave any tracks?" asked Skeet. "Just a few big footprints. I had Old Man Sullivan take a look. He said they were just like the ones he saw up on the creek last fall." By February, winter had settled into our blood and slowed our adventurous metabolisms to a crawl. The days were cold, dark, and boring. Our memories from summer and fall were used up, and prospects for warm weather escapades were far off, somewhere on the other side of mid-March. We got up in the dark morning, walked to school with the streetlights still on, and by the time we got out of school, the sun had already set. It was a miserable way to spend week after week, locked inside a torturous classroom the entire time that the sun was visible. Even teacher baiting lost some of its luster. The only good argument we had got going in weeks was with Mr. Hundfoss, our English teacher. "Synonyms," he said, "are words that share the same or similar meanings, like tizzy and tantrum. Antonyms are words with opposite meanings, like purify and taint." Skeet raised his hand and said smugly, "And tizzy is an antonym of taint." Mr. Hundfoss looked at Skeet awkwardly. "What in the world are you talking about, Mr. Barth?" "Well," said Skeet, winking at a nearby girl, "I'll use them in a sentence. Let's say one guy is asking a second guy if a third guy is insane. The first guy might say, 'Tizzy crazy?' And the second guy would answer, 'No, he tain't.'" Skeet smiled triumphantly as the class broke out into laughter. Mr. Hundfoss balled up his fists as his face turned pink. "All right, Mr. Barth," he said quietly. "That'll be enough of that." He cleared his throat. "Now then, a homonym is when two words are spelled or pronounced the same but have different meanings. Without raising my hand, I asked, "So are synonyms antonyms of homonyms?" Mr. Hundfoss momentarily lost control of his cheek muscles. "Well," he said slowly, giving the matter some thought, "I guess so. I guess you could say that. Why do you ask?" I said, "I was just wondering." "I don't get it," Mr. Hundfoss said, taking a step backward. "Where's the joke?" "Honest," I said, "I was just asking, trying to learn." He straightened his belt, tugged on his sweater. "I'm watching you, Lep. There's something in that question that is supposed to foul me up, but I'm on to you." The class began giggling. "See," he shouted, "I don't get it, but I bet it's dirty." He was pointing at me, glaring. Skeet asked, "What are some other synonyms?" Caught off guard, Mr. Hundfoss jerked his head toward Skeeter. "Well," he said, pulling his sweater down again, "I suppose but and yet are synonymous." "I don't think so," replied Skeet. "What?" asked Mr. Hundfoss. "Do you have a degree in English?" "No," answered Skeet. "But I think yet suggests something positive, while but implies a negative." "I think the two words are interchangeable, but if you're so sure, give me an example," said Hundfoss smugly. Skeet leaned back in his chair while Hundfoss walked around his desk, opened the center drawer, pulled out a bottle of antacids, and swallowed two. "Well," he asked Skeet, "have you come up with an example where but and yet are not synonyms?" Skeet said, "Not but, yet I'm thinking." Hundfoss fell into his chair. "Mr. Barth," he said after a moment, "you are not funny. The grade you are getting in this class is not funny. You are clever, I'll give you that. But speaking grammatically, I seriously doubt that you or your friend Mr. Lep could put an asterisk on your colon if you had two ands and a but." The class sat silent, stunned at Hundfoss's sudden wit. And then everyone, including Skeet and Hundfoss, laughed brightly. It wasn't much, but it gave us that much more reason and courage to press on towards spring. On the way out of class, Hundfoss stopped us and said, "Look, you boys need a little extra credit in this class. You're supposed to graduate at the end of this term. The whole town hopes you both will get accepted to colleges far away from here. I will do anything I can for this town and its dreams. It would be so nice if you boys went to college in Iraq or Siberia or North Korea or some such, but you need to pass this class to do it, so I'll give you a chance. You boys write me a paper, a 10-page paper, on any subject you want, and I'll make sure you pass my class with flying colors." "Siberia would be neat," I said to Skeet. "Yeah, they have tigers there," he said. "And the Yeti," Hundfoss injected. "That's it," Skeet shouted. "We'll write a paper on the Yeti that old man Sullivan saw." Forced to endure the tripartite hardships of indoor activities, school, and a research paper, Skeet and I took a drastic step. We went to the public library. We had decided that with nothing else to do and no real adventures to be had, we might as well look up Bigfoot in the library and find out what we could. As we stepped in the door of the public library, Mrs. Fist jerked involuntarily. She looked at her desk, calendar, and croaked, "You're early. You boys usually don't invade this building until after Valentine's Day." "It's been a hard winter, Mrs. Fist," I said apologetically. "We won't be any trouble," Skeet said. Mrs. Fist snorted. "The first peep I hear out of you, and I call the sheriff. You didn't bring those little fishing poles, did you?" she asked. We shook our heads. This question was in reference to the time Skeet and I had learned that there were microfish at the library. It was an embarrassing, if understandable, error on our part. "We need books on the Bigfoot," Skeet said proudly. "Glory be," Mrs. Fist said, her hand going to her chest. "What on earth for?" We are doing some research on the rumors and writing a paper for Mr. Hundfoss, Skeet answered. Well, you cannot do any experiments in here. It was always satisfying to make a librarian shout, especially before we had done anything but request materials. Mrs. Fist knew better than to send us to the card catalog. It was quicker and less painful for her to just pull up the call numbers we needed on her computer and point us in the general direction of the books. This time, though, she seemed to be one step ahead of us. She had a pile of books and articles about Bigfoot on the counter behind her desk. "Lucky for you," she said, "I just happen to have a whole collection of materials right here." She patted the pile, then handed them over to us. After about an hour of reading, Skeet finally said, "There has never been a reliable sighting of the Bigfoot in these parts. They're all out west or up in Canada." "And the Yeti," I added, "seems to only show up in Asia. So what we have here, if the rumors can be believed, is an as-yet undiscovered breed of Sasquatch." "I guess we get to name it," said Skeet. "I mean, we are doing the initial study. We might even get to write the story for National Geographic. So we better come up with a good name." We sat quietly, thinking. "I've got it," Skeet said, slapping the table. "The Butty." "The Butty?" I asked. "Yep, because it sounds like the Yeti, but not exactly like it. What we have is a creature synonymous with the Bigfoot and the Yeti, so we call it the Butty." "How do we spell it? I mean, if it's just a combination of the words, that would be B-E-T-I, and that would be pronounced Betty. But we can't have people thinking this terrible monster is named Betty. It wouldn't strike fear into their hearts. People might think it's gentle, approach it, and get hurt." "I see what you mean. We can't spell it B-U-T-I, because people would think it was beauty, and that's no name for a monster," Skeet added. We sat a bit longer. Finally, from the desk across the room, Mrs. Fist said, "B-U-T-T-I, and don't giggle because I spelled butt." "No, ma'am," I said. "That's a great way to spell it. Butty." We had our beast named. We knew its habits. Now we just had to find him. "Could it be," I whispered to Skeeter, "that something spilled?" "What could have spilled?" he hissed back. "Maybe," Skeet said, "a canteen spilled." "Did you bring a canteen into the tent?" I asked. "No, did you?" Skeet said. "No, did Rudy?" I hinted. Rudy was Skeeter's 9-year-old cousin. He was visiting with Skeet's family, and Skeeter's mother had forced us to take Rudy with us on our overnight buddy expedition. We were 18-year-olds, and having a kid half our age along was not our idea of relaxing. First of all, Mrs. Barth had made us leave our guns at home so we wouldn't shoot Rudy. Camping was all right by itself, and we enjoyed the break from time to time, from home, but hunting was better. And there was, after all, a Bigfoot on the loose in the area. The fact that the temperature was supposed to drop below zero during the night hadn't really bothered us. We liked to test our camping skills, but now with the sun creeping over the mountain tops and our breaths hanging in the tent, we were becoming frustrated. However, somehow, during the night, the floor of the tent had become coated with liquid, and then subsequently with ice. Our sleeping bags, we had discovered, were frozen solid to the floor of the tent, and neither of us could get our arms out of our tight mummy bags. We were stuck. Rudy was snoring contentedly by the door. "So," Skeet said, "what could have spilled?" "Besides your cousin, I don't know," I retorted. "What are you trying to say?" "I'm trying to say, could your cousin have... Well, is there any chance that we are lying in his frozen..." From somewhere outside the tent came the sound of frozen bushes being pushed apart. This was followed by feet crunching in the snow and the snort of a rooting animal. Rudy woke up with a jolt and screamed a long, blood-thawing, "Ah!" There was a terrifying ripping as he lurched up, bending at the hips until his head hit his toes. He couldn't have looked more like a human mousetrap slapping shut if he had tried. The back of his sleeping bag, which was just as frozen to the floor as ours, ripped loose from the rest of the sleeping bag and lay in the ice. Light blue fabric held fast by light blue ice, with tiny down feathers frozen in the ice, swaying in the disturbed air. And then, with a screeching like a nail coming out of a board, Rudy pulled himself free of the ruined bag, unzipped the tent, and ran shrieking toward home. "Well," Skeeter said, "he might have at least had the courtesy to say goodbye." "Or at least zip the tent back up," I added. "Did you notice that he was fully dressed? Shoes and everything? Did he sleep like that?" Skeet wondered out loud. We lay there, frozen to the floor of a new tent in new sleeping bags, with the flap open, snow blowing in on top of us as the sun rose, and Rudy's cries causing avalanches to rumble down nearby mountains. The rooting noises outside had ceased. "I don't want to die here like this, but I'll be darned if I am going to sit up and tear my new mummy bag," I said. "Me too," agreed Skeet. "Maybe if we lay here long enough, the bags will thaw," I suggested. We lay quietly for a few minutes, and then Skeet asked, "What do you suppose got into Rudy? A nightmare or something?" I'm less worried about what got into Rudy than about what got out of Rudy, and thus what we are frozen in, I said. "Maybe we shouldn't have told him about the buddy," Skeet said. "We had to. He's a kid. You're supposed to scare them on camping trips," I opined. The bushes outside rustled again. The snow crunched, and the rooting and grunting came close to the tent. "I hope," I whispered, that it is not a skunk out there." I wiggled my shoulders and knees quietly, hoping to break free of the ice. "If it's a bear, we can just play dead. If it's a skunk, I'm going to get out of here, sleeping bag and all," Skeet whispered back. We lay still. The rooting continued. Trying to say it with a laugh, I said, "You don't reckon it's the buddy, do you?" I heard Skeet jerk around in his bag. He forced a laugh and said, "No, there's no such thing." Something brushed against the tent wall, about 2 feet off the ground, to the left of the open door. It was a large something. I swallowed hard. There was a snuffling, and then the frozen breath of a large beast carried on the breeze drifted in a thick cloud through the open door of the tent. I swallowed harder. The large something moved just to the edge of the open door and grunted. I swallowed my hardest, so hard that I pulled a muscle in my neck, and my Adam's apple nearly turned to applesauce. I lay perfectly still, except for my uncontrollable shivering, with my eyes shut hard. Skeet was scared stiff, which, under the circumstances, was the best way to be scared. If it was a bear, Skeet would appear dead. I would look to the bear like a nervous pig in a poke. After a few moments, I carefully opened one eye and then screamed, "Buddy!" When my scream died down and I calmed enough to see straight, I saw that the hairy face of the buddy disappeared into a checked wool hunting coat. Odd. And then I heard Skeet say, "Oh, hello, Mr. Sullivan. What are you doing up here? Your winter beard is coming along nicely." Old Man Sullivan raised a gloved hand and stroked his beard. "Thanks," he said. I was thinking that very thing myself. "So besides screaming bloody murder, what are you boys doing up here?" "Oh," Skeet said, "just camping." "Why are you still in bed? You're missing the best part of the day." "Well," Skeet said, trying to shrug, "we're sort of, well, frozen in place." Old Man Sullivan studied on the problem for a few minutes, muttered to himself, and then lit a fire. He rummaged in our gear until he found a cook pot, heated some water, and then carefully poured the water under our sleeping bags. The ice thawed quickly, and we hopped out of the bags, changed into dry clothes, and then expressed our thanks to Mr. Sullivan. We leaned our now refreezing bags against a tree. "What was that you yelled when I stuck my head in the tent?" Old Man Sullivan asked me. "Oh, that," I said, "Buddy." "And what, pray tell, does Buddy mean?" he asked. He explained the origin. We explained the origin of the species. While we talked, Sullivan seemed to study us with great interest. Then he nodded his head and said, "Hum," and stroked his beard. He patted his rifle and said, "Well, if I see the buddy out there, I'm not going to take any chances. Those tracks I saw were huge. This buddy ain't no beast to be toyed with." Then he stood, nodded at us, and walked off into the woods. "Well," said Skeet, "no sense sticking around here. We can't camp tonight with the sleeping bags frozen. We might as well take down the tent, pack up, and then explore for the day. We'll come back at dusk, get our gear, and head home." We piled everything together and then headed off into the cold, cold morning. After a while, it occurred to us that Rudy had run off into the woods alone and that he might not know his way home. "And," Skeet added, "there's the buddy to consider. What if Rudy runs into him?" "You'd have one less annoying little cousin," I said, "and one mad mother and one mad aunt. We'd better make sure he made it home." We turned in our tracks, grabbed our gear at the camp, and followed Rudy's footprints toward town. After about a mile, another set of prints joined Rudy's. It swept in from a thick clump of pine trees and then paralleled Rudy's tracks. The prints were sunk deep in the snow, were at least 18 inches long, and had 5 toes with claws extending from each digit. And whatever it was, it walked on 2 feet. We doubled our pace, followed the 2 sets of prints, and around a bend, and then stopped in our tracks. Rudy's prints disappeared. All that was left were the big tracks of the buddy, and they left the trail and headed into the woods. We quickly turned and tracked the buddy into the woods, expecting at any moment to find the bones of the little kid stuffed under a bush. Amazingly, after about 200 yards, Rudy's tracks reappeared, as though the buddy had dropped him. Rudy's tracks slid back toward the trail, and the buddy's continued deeper into the woods. Rudy's tracks made it all the way home, and we found him in the kitchen, being nursed by Skeet's mother and aunt. He was pale and spent. After a few minutes, he recounted the tale of how he had been running along toward the house when a giant, ape-like beast had rushed up behind him, snatched him up, and carried him off into the woods. Mrs. Barth had called Sheriff Hasbro, and he brought Old Man Sullivan. They questioned Rudy for some time. They finally decided that he had not made up the story, and that we were not responsible for the episode, thanks to Old Man Sullivan, who vouched that he had spoken with us for some time after Rudy had run off. "No way they could have done it," he concluded. It was sad. It was a sad thing to be the town's best troublemakers and not even be suspected of causing the biggest ruckus in recent memory. The snow fell hard that night, covering the tracks of the buddy. There was no way to follow him. We stayed near the house all that day. When the evening newspaper came out, the headline read, "Visiting Youngster Abducted by Buddy." The article went on to say that the town council would hold a private meeting the next night to discuss the buddy problem. Skeet and I sat silent for a long time, pondering. Skeet suddenly stiffened. He jerked his head toward me, his eyes big and wide. "I heard my mother on the phone when she was inviting my aunt and Rudy to come down," he said. "So?" I said. "I remember. She said, 'We're trying to keep the boys out of trouble. Winter gets them all worked up and bored. Can you and Rudy come down for a little surprise?'" he recounted. "Think about it." I thought, and then I smiled. "I think I know how to catch the buddy." "Me too," he whispered. "Let's go." We went. We were out very late, gathering our gear and setting our trap. 15 minutes after the private town council meeting started, we burst through the doors of City Hall. Proudly, Skeet announced, "Ladies and gentlemen of the council, we have presently captured the buddy." Gasps escaped from all the members of the council. "Lights!" Skeet yelled. I switched off the lights, sending the council room into pitch blackness, and then I pulled a cord, releasing the huge cargo net Skeet and I had bought from Sullivan's flea market some time ago. The net fell from where we had suspended it under a false ceiling and landed with a thump. There were muffled screams and curses from the council. I turned the lights back on. All the members of the town council, Sheriff Hasbro, Old Man Sullivan, Mrs. Fist, Mr. Hunfoss, and Mrs. Barth, looked out at us from beneath the net. I walked up to Skeet, who just shook his head at the council members. Skeet said, "I am ashamed of all of you. Surely you could have come up with a better way to keep us out of trouble than to invent the buddy. I'll admit it was a clever plan, having Old Man Sullivan start the rumor way back in autumn, getting us mindful of the idea, and then to slowly but steadily keep reminding us of it. But to involve Rudy, a child, shame on you. Someone could have gotten hurt." He shook his head again. The council members studied their hands and the tabletop from beneath the net. "Mr. Hunfoss," I asked, "do we still owe you a paper?" He glanced up, then at the members of the council, then at us. Softly, he said, "No, I don't suppose so." "Well, then," Skeet said, "I guess we'll just go see what we can get into." "One last thing," I said. "Why did you freeze us to the floor of the tent?" Old Man Sullivan smiled. Laughing, he said, "We didn't. That was all Rudy's doing. What you might call an accident brought on by too much hot chocolate and fear." "I knew it," I shouted at Skeet. "My brand new sleeping bag." And when we left the buddy, trapped and chagrined, but wiser for its efforts. If left alone, the buddy would be far more dangerous come next winter, but Skeeter and I were now old enough to vote, and the town elections were just a few months away. As it turns out, the buddy is a mythical creature, able to strike fear and politics into the hearts of even the most apathetic constituents. We've run out of time for today's episode of That's a Laugh. We hope you've enjoyed it. Please be sure to listen next time. I'm Jennifer Green, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. That's a Laugh is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. That's ncreadingservice.org. Are you enjoying the show? Do you have any humorous quotes or authors you'd like to share? We'd love to hear from you. If you have any questions or comments about this or any other NCRS shows, please call us at 919-832-5138. That number, one more time, is 919-832-5138. We thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.